And now, our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's A Town Called Fury. Book 4, Redemption. By William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Danny Gavigan, Thomas Penny, Thomas Keegan, Stephen Carpenter, Sherry Simpson, Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, Kate Foster, Alexander Strain, James Konacek, Christopher Graybill, Joseph Thornhill, Bradley Smith, Alyssa Wilmoth, Casey Platt, Gregory Gordon, Sonny Lasky, Richard Rowan, Kimberly Gilbert, Joe Brack, M.B. Van Dorn, and Ken Jackson.
The black, biting wind was so strong and so fierce that Jason feared there was no more skin left on his upper face, the only part not covered by his hat or bandana. Whoever had decided to call these things dust storms had never been in one. He knew that for certain. Oh, they might start out with dust, but as they grew, they picked up everything from pebbles to grit to bits of plants and sticks. He'd been told they could rip whole branches from trees and arms off cacti and add them into the whirling, filthy mess, blasting small buildings and leaving nothing behind but splinters. He hadn't believed it then. He did now. At last, he reached his office, or at least he thought it was, and put his shoulder into the door. He hadn't needed to. The wind took it, slamming both the door and Jason against the wall. It took him over 5 minutes to will both his body and the door into cooperating, but he finally got it closed. He would rather have been cursing up a storm than coughing one up, but when it finally stopped, a good long drink from the water bucket put the world right side up. Well, mostly. He still couldn't breathe through his nose.
Thank God the storm's at least keeping everyone inside, including Rafe Lynch.
Rafe Lynch was wanted for 8 killings in California and was currently ensconced at Abigail Crimp's bar and whorehouse up the street. Jason didn't know much about Lynch, other than he was clean in fury, and for that matter, the whole of Arizona, and Jason was therefore constrained by law to keep his paws off him. Actually, he felt relieved. He wasn't quite sure if he and his deputy, Ward Wanamaker, would be up to handling the situation if Lynch tried to stir up some trouble. Outside the jailhouse walls, the storm pounded harder and harsher. Dust seeped in everywhere, around the door and the windows, even up through the plank floor. This occurrence left Jason puzzled. He knew damn well that the floor had only 2 inches or less of clearance above the dirt underneath. He'd managed to make his rounds, although a bit early. It was only 3 in the afternoon. Despite the darkness of the dust and crud-blackened sky, everyone was inside, boarded up against the wind and wrapped in blankets against the storm's detritus and the sudden chill that had accompanied it.
Couldn't we have just gotten a nice rain? Yeah, I must look a sight.
At least, That's what his sister Jenny would have said, had she been there to see him. But she was nestled up over at Kendall's boarding house with her best friend, Megan McDonald. Or she was at home, madly trying to sweep up the dust and grit that wouldn't stop coming. Jason's thoughts again returned to Rafe Lynch. It gnawed on him that Lynch was even in town.
My town, damn it. Well, not actually mine.
The settlers had christened it Fury after his father, Jedediah Fury, a legendary wagon master who had been killed on the trail coming out from Kansas City. He supposed the place's name was attractive to scofflaws, who seemed, out of all proportion, drawn to the tiny, peaceful town in the Arizona Territory.
And why can't they ride on over to Mendacity, or Rage, or Suicide, or Hang Dog, or Ravage Nuns? Now, there's a town I don't want anything to do with.
His sand-gritted eyes were weary, and so was he. He glanced up at the wall clock again. 3:30. No way that Ward was going to make it down here on time, if he came at all. Well, Jason figured it wouldn't hurt him to get a little shut-eye. So he put his head down on his dusty arms, which were folded on the desk. Despite the battering storm outside, he was asleep in 5 minutes. Roughly 25 minutes to the west of Fury, a small train of Conestoga wagons fought their way through the dust storm. Riley Havens, the wagon master, had seen it coming. The sky growing darker to the east, the wind coming up, the way the livestock skittered on the ends of their tie ropes, and the occasional dust devils that swirled their way across the expanses on either side of them. But now the edge of the darkness was upon them. Riley reined in his horse and held up his hand, signaling for the wagons to halt. Almost immediately, Ferris Bond, his ramrod for the journey, rode up on him.
What the devil is that thing, Riley? Looks like we're riding direct into the mouth of hell!
We are! Get the wagon circled in, tag!
What about Samson Davis? He rode off south about an hour ago!
Ah, screw him!
Riley turned to help get the settlers with their wagons and livestock in a circle. Down southeast of town, the storm wasn't as much sand and grit as twigs and branches, and Wash Keough, who'd been working the same chunk of land for the past few years, was huddled in a shallow cave, along with his horse and all his worldly possessions. Well, the ones that the wind hadn't already taken, that was. But despite the storm, Wash was a wildly happy man, because he held in his hand a hunk of gold the size of a turkey egg. It wasn't pure. There was quartz veining. But it sure enough weighed a ton, and he was pretty sure that the mother lode was just upstream. Up the dry creek bed, that was. Just a little ways.
Oh, this damn wind would only stop blowing. Well, hell, I might just turn out to be the richest man in the whole dang territory.
That thought sure put a smile on his weathered old face, but he ended up with a mouthful of mud. The grit leaked in no matter how many bandanas he tied over his face. Well, he could smile later. The main thing now was just to last out the storm. Like him, his horse waded out the wind with his back to it and his head down. Smart critters, horses. He should have paid more attention when the gelding started acting prancy and agitated. But Wash didn't see how a man could have paid attention to anything else when that big old doorstop of gold was sitting right there in his hand. He'd bet he would have missed out on the second coming if it had happened right there in front of him. He hunkered down against the howl of the storm to wait it out. But he was happy. Very happy. Back inside the stockaded walls of Fury, Solomon Cohen, who had been known as Saul until he changed it back to Solomon during a crisis in faith several months back, was huddled in the mercantile with Rachel, his wife, and the boys, Jacob, David, and Abraham. The back room of the mercantile was fairly tight, and so they had planted themselves there for the duration. Solomon's crisis had come after a long time with no other Jews in town, no one else who spoke Yiddish, no one with an ancestry in common with himself or Rachel. Oh, there was her, of course, but it wasn't like having another Jewish man around to share things with, to complain with, to laugh with, and to spend the Sabbath with. and now Rachel was with child once again. He feared that they would lose this one, as they had the last two, and each night his prayers were filled with the unborn child, wishing it to be well and prosper. He didn't care whether God would give him a boy or a girl. He just heartily prayed that Jehovah would give him a child who breathed, who would grow up straight and tall, and who would be a good Jew. Still, he wished for another Jewish presence in Fury. A man, a woman, a family. His children had no prospects of marriage in this town filled with goyim. If they were to marry, they would likely have to go away to California, to one of the big cities like San Francisco. It was a prospect he dreaded, and he knew Rachel did too. They had talked of it many times. They had even spoken of it long before the children's births, when they first met in New York City. And Solomon spoke of his dreams of the West and the fortunes that could be made if a man was smart and handy and careful with his money. It had taken him over 10 years, plus his marriage to Rachel and 3 babies, all sons, to talk her into it, but at last she relented. Although he always remembered that she had cautioned him that they didn't know if the West held any other Jews that their children could marry, or would want to.
As always, she was right.
He looked at her, resting fitfully on the old day bed they kept down here, her belly so swollen with child that she looked as if she might pop at any second. And he felt again a pang of love for her, for the baby. She was so beautiful, his wife. He was lucky to have her, blessed that she'd had him. The wind hadn't yet shown any signs of lessening, and so he slouched down farther in his rocker and carefully stuck his legs out between David and Abraham, who were sound asleep on the floor. Glancing over at Jacob to make sure he was all right too, Solomon said yet another silent prayer, then closed his eyes. Almost instantaneously, he was asleep. The Reverend Milcher angrily paced the center aisle between the rows of pews. Not that they had ever needed them. Not that they'd ever been filled.
Not that anybody in town appears to give a good damn.
Even though he hadn't spoken aloud, he stopped immediately and clapped his hand over his mouth. From a front pew, Lavinia, his long-suffering wife, looked up from her dusty knitting and stared at him.
Did you have an impure thought, Lewis?
Milcher wiped more sand from his mouth.
Yes, dear. I thought a sinful word.
I hope you apologized to the Lord.
Yes, dear, I did.
They were running out of food, and he needed to fill the church with folks who would donate to hear the word of the Lord. That or bring a chicken. He had tried and tried, but nothing he did seemed to bring in the people he needed to keep his church running.
And now this infernal dust storm. Is the Lord trying to punish me? What could I have possibly done?
Again, he stopped stock still. But this time, his hand went to the side of his head instead of his mouth.
That's it! The dust storm! Oh, the Lord has sent me a sign as sure as anything.
Lewis?
What?
You stopped walking again.
I've had a revelation, Lavinia. I need some time to think it through. Good night, dear.
Before she could ask about it, he soberly went to the side of the altar, opened the door, and started up the stairs.
Oh.
Lavinia stood up and began to smack the dust out of the garment she'd been knitting. She kept on whacking at it, as if she were beating back fury, beating back her marriage and this awful storm, beating back all the bad things in her life.
Oh.
At last, she wearily stilled her hand and started upstairs. When Jason woke, he still found himself alone, surrounded by unfettered wind whipping at the walls. And it was, according to the clock, 10:45, and there was no Ward in evidence. It figured that Ward wouldn't brave the storm to come to the office.
Hope he found himself a nice, secure place to hole up in. Gotta get to the Mercantile, see if they have any caulking. When the storm lets up, if it ever does, make this place airtight if it kills me.
There was still dust coming in around the windows and the front door, and right up through the floor. He didn't want to see what was happening around the back door, but he knew it would be bad. It wasn't nearly as tight as the front one.
Damn it.
Jason shot to his feet and went to the door to the back room. He expected to be met by the full force of the storm and the outer door hanging off its hinges. But instead, he found Ward struggling to close the back door. He fought back the urge to laugh and instead helped Ward. The two men succeeded in closing and latching the door, and Ward leaned his back against it, his head drooping, his hair hanging in his eyes.
You look like you've been rode hard and put up wet, man.
Ward looked Jason up and down.
I feel worse. You don't much look like a go-to-town slicker yourself either, boss.
Jason smiled, then led him into the main part of the office.
There's clean water in the bucket. You want coffee, you're gonna have to make it yourself.
Ward went to the bucket and had himself two dippers of water, then splashed another on the back of his neck.
You ever seen a storm like this?
I never even heard of one.
Well, I heard about them, but this one's sure a rip-snorter. Don't believe I ever heard tell of one lasting so long or going so hard. What I come to tell you, one of the Milcher kids is missing. Found the river and out looking for him, but you know him. He's like buttered beef in a crisis. Made him go home.
When'd he go missing?
Sometime between 7 and 9:30. The Reverend thinks he's out looking for the cat. She's missing, too.
Jason pushed himself up. He shook out his bandana and tied it over his nose and mouth.
I reckon now's as good a time as any. You rest up. Come out when you're ready.
But Ward was on his feet, his clothes dribbling sand on the floor.
Nah, I'll go with you. Four eyes are better than two, or so they tell me.
Appreciate it. Pull your hat brim low.
Whoa!
Jason had a firm hold on the door latch, but the sudden influx of wind shoved Ward off his feet and into the filing cabinets.
You want to warn a fellow before you do that?
Sorry, Ward.
Ward slowly got back to his feet, using his hands and back for traction. He made it to the desk and finally to the door.
We're gonna have to get outside and pull like crazy, okay?
Ward nodded, and they did, each bracing a boot on either side of the door frame. It took them nearly 5 minutes, but eventually, the door was closed and latched.
Which kid was it?
Milcher!
There were a bunch of Milcher kids.
Which Milcher kid?
Peter, the 5-year-old!
Great, just great. 5-year-old kid lost in this.
A grown man could barely keep his footing, but Peter was a tough little kid. If he had survived the trip out west in his mother's belly, he could survive anything. At least, that's what Jason hoped. He tried to think like a 5-year-old following a cat and set off, staggering against the buffeting wind toward the stables.
Follow me!
Up at the stable, they found several head of cattle and a couple of saddle horses standing out in the corral, all with their heads down and their butts into the wind. Jason wondered if they could get them inside once they found the Milcher boy. It didn't take them long at all once they pulled the barn door closed.
Peter!
Ward heard it first, and Jason followed him back to a rear stall, where Jason uncovered the boy hiding beneath a saddle blanket.
Peter?
When the boy looked up, his face was streaked by the trails of tears through the crust of dust and grit on his face.
My daddy's gonna kill me. But I had to find Louise. She's gonna have kittens, and she's having them right now.
He pointed down next to him in the straw, and there was the Milcher's cat, with the third or fourth kitten just emerging. Jason put an arm around the boy.
Get a crate, Ward. Don't worry, Peter. Your daddy's not gonna kill you. In fact, he was out looking for you. He was so worried.
Ward handed him an apple crate in which he'd already placed a fresh saddle blanket.
He was?
He was indeed. Now let's see what we got here.
Jason gently lifted the mother cat while Ward stooped over him, carefully bringing the still-attached kitten along, and they placed them in the apple crate.
Good. Now let's see who else is here.
He found not three, but four other kittens. Three were tabby and white, and one was all white. By the time the men got them all back with their mother, she had finished giving birth to the fifth kitten, had cut the cord, and was busy licking it clean.
Good kitty. Good mama.
Jason and Ward stood up, and Jason held his hand down to the boy.
Guess we best get the lot of you back home.
Ward sifted through the stack of saddle blankets and dug out a relatively fresh one, covering the box snugly. Peter grabbed Jason's hand and pulled himself to his feet.
But the baby cats can't go back. Daddy doesn't like them. He says he doesn't like the smell of birth.
Reckon he's just gonna have to get over it.
Jason lifted Peter up into his arms, then threw a blanket over him.
Y'all snugged up in there?
Yes, sir.
With Ward carrying the box of kittens and their mama, the men pushed their way out into the storm again. The wind hit Jason like a slap in the face.
Believe it's letting up some.
Jason just forged ahead toward the Milcher's place. Thankfully, it wasn't far, and when he rapped on the church door, Mrs. Milcher threw it wide.
Oh, is he all right? Is he all right?
Peter wiggled out of the blanket.
I'm fine, Mama. Louise had her babies.
Ward set the box down and lifted the cover. Mrs. Milcher cupped her boy's face in her hands.
Oh, is that why you went out, honey, to find Louise?
Yes'm, and I did, too. She was in the stables.
Mrs. Milcher looked up at Jason.
Oh, she always wants to hide when she feels her time's here. What a night to pick.
Miss Milcher, ma'am, I know you've given away kittens before, and I was wondering if...
Certainly, Marshall. Anyone you want.
I kind of fancy the little white one. Got a name for him already and everything.
But you don't even know if it's a boy or a girl, do you?
No, ma'am. Wasn't time to check, but I figured to call it Dusty. Name works either way, I reckon. And I'll never forget when he was born.
No, I don't suppose you will. Thank you, Marshall. Thank you for everything. My husband would thank you as well, I'm sure. But he has retired for the night.
Well, take care of young Peter here, and watch over my kitten till it's ready to leave its mama.
He and Ward both tipped their hats, and both stepped through the doors at once. But instead of the whip of wind that Jason was expecting, they stepped out into cool, clear, still air.
What happened?
I guess it quit.
Guess so. You want to go up and get a drink?
Nope. I want to go home and wash up.
Yeah, I reckon that sounds good, too. Well, you go on ahead, Jason. I'll have a drink for both of us.
Just one, Ward. You're on duty, you know.
Jason turned around and started the walk back to his house. The air felt humid, as if rain was coming. He hoped it was. Nothing would feel better right now than to just strip off his clothes and stand out in his front yard naked. He chuckled to himself. Yeah, there'd be hell to pay if Mrs. Clancy saw him. But on the other hand, she wasn't likely to be awake at 11 at night.
Jenny'd skin me, though. It is a terrible thing to be ruled by women.
Then he pictured Megan McDonald and grinned.
Well, there are exceptions to every rule.
It did rain. And while Jason was outside, beaming and standing stark naked in his front yard with a bar of soap in his hand, miles away, the wagon train was getting the worst of the dust storm. The wagons had been tightly circled, and all the livestock had been unhitched and brought to the center, but the wind was remorseless, pitiless. Young Bill Cratchit thought that maybe God was mad at them for giving up on the dream of California, and he huddled inside his old used wagon, praying. The Solomonk family, two wagons down, held their children close, hoping it would just stop. Well, Eliza Solomonk did. Her husband Frank had the thankless job of trying to hold the wagon's canopy in place. The train had lost three already to the torrent of grit and dirt and cactus thorns. He was around the far side when, out of nowhere, an arm of a saguaro cactus hit him in the back like a bag of nail-filled bricks.
Ah!
He went down, but was helped to his feet a moment later by Riley Havens, who yanked the cactus, stuck to Frank by its two-inch spines, free. Blood ran down Frank's back in 100 little drizzles, soaking his shirt, and Riley helped him back up inside the wagon.
Saguaro! Get those thorns out!
Oh, Frank!
Never letting go of the children, she moved back to her husband and immediately began to ease him out of his shirt. Riley left her to take care of her man and struggled next door to the Grimm's wagon. Their canopy had blown off earlier. It had taken 4 men to chase it down and get it tied back in place. And that had been before the wind came up so damned hard. He doubted they could repeat their performance. All was well with the Grimms, except their dog. He was a cross between a red-bone hound and a Louisiana black-mouthed cur, and the wind had brought out the hound side of him in spades. The Grimms had covered their heads with blankets and quilts, trying to hold off the noise of him and the storm.
No, shut up!
Riley moved on to the next wagon and left the howling beast behind. The raw wind still raked at his ears, even though he'd tied his hat down with one scarf, then covered his nose and mouth with a second one. But the grit still got through somehow, working its insidious way up his nose and into his mouth. His eyes were crusted with it, and even his ears were stuffed.
I must look like hell.
He surprised himself by smiling beneath the layers. The whole world looked like hell tonight. He wasn't the only one. Slowly staggering, he made his way to a new wagon to check in and give what reassurances he could, which weren't many.
This is the last train I'm gonna ferry out or back. I'm done.
Back in Fury, it was still raining come the morning, although it had settled into a slow but steady drizzle. And it didn't take much water for an Arizona inhabitant to forget the dust. When Jason walked down the street to the office, he didn't pass a single water trough that wasn't filled to the brim. And grimy from all the gritty, dusty cowhands helping themselves to a free bath. Jason pitied the horses that had to drink from those troughs. So he turned and walked into the office, expecting one hell of a mess that'd need cleaning up. But to his surprise, Ward had spent a busy night with the push broom and the cleaning cloths.
Huh. Ward was right.
Hell, this place hasn't been this clean since we built it.
When he looked out back, he found that even the bedding from the cells had been hung out in the rain and was now hanging damply from the lines.
Wash and dry in one move, that's Ward.
Southeast of town, Wash Keogh was looking like mad for his gold vein, the one he was certain was going to make him rich, and the one from which he carried a turkey egg-sized chunk in his pants pocket. He'd been searching all morning, but nothing, absolutely nothing, had shown up. He had expected to find himself confronted with a shimmering wall of gold, the kind they wrote about in those strike-it-rich dime novels. But no, nothing. Had somebody been in here before him and cleaned it all out? It sure looked that way. Maybe the chunk he'd found had simply been tossed away like so much trash. He turned his face heavenward.
What did those other boys do right that I done wrong? I lived me a good life, moved settlers back and forth, protected them from the heathen Indians. I worked with or for the best. Jedediah Fury, Whiskey Hank Ruskin, and Herbert Bower, to name just 3. All good, godly men. I brung nuns to Santa Fe and a rabbi to San Diego for criminy's sake, and I guarded that preacher and his family to Fury. All right, I do my share of cussing, some say more, and I like my hoo-hit John, but so do them priests of yours. What more do you want from me?
There was no answer. Only the endless, clear blue sky.
Okay, another hour. Another hour, and then I'll have myself some lunch.
He set off again, his eyes to the ground, keenly watching for any little hint of glittering gold. It was Sunday, and Jason had let his sister Jenny sleep in. She was probably tuckered out from the storm. He knew he was. The girls, Megan McDonald was with her, woke at 9, and both ran to the window at the sound of softly pattering rain.
Thank God, rain.
Jenny rested her hand, palm out, on the window pane.
And it's cool. Megan, feel.
She took Megan's hand and pressed its palm against the pane.
My gosh, it's cold. Oh, it's not cold, Meg, just cool. I wonder if Jason's up.
Jenny set off down the hall to wake him, but found his room empty except for an absolutely filthy pile of clothes heaped on the floor, dead center.
He's gone. Well, I hope he had the good sense to take a bath.
She turned and walked up the hall toward the kitchen, where Megan was already rooting through the cupboards. A little while later, after both girls had washed last night's grime out of their hair and off their bodies, they had themselves a good breakfast, then walked uptown toward Solomon and Rachel's store. The storm, long gone by now, hadn't shaken Jenny's hens, who had taken shelter in the low haymow of Jason's little barn and subsequently laid a record number of eggs. The girls' aim was to sell the excess eggs and find a new broom and dustpan. This seemed like the time, what with the floors of the house nearly ankle-deep in detritus. They had barely reached the mercantile and were standing, staring in the window, when the sky suddenly opened again. Rain began to pelt them in huge, hard drops, and Megan grabbed Jenny's hand.
Come on!
Jenny skidded along the walk behind Megan, the egg basket swinging from her other hand.
Wait! The door's back the other way, Meg! Come on, the mercantile's closed, Jenny! It is?
Jenny began to run alongside Megan then, and what Megan was headed for wasn't a very nice place. It was Abigail Crimp's.
Any port in the storm surely beats standing out here.
Abigail was holding the door for them, and they ran directly inside. It was the first time either one of them had so much as peeked inside a place like Abigail's. But Abigail was just as nice as Jenny remembered from the trip coming out. Why, she didn't look sullied at all. That's what Mrs. Milcher always called her. And then it occurred to her that she didn't even know what sullied meant. And Jenny called herself Miss Morton's assistant schoolmarm. Abigail put a hand on each girl's shoulder. She led them to the first of three tables and sat them down.
Why don't you young ladies have a seat while you wait it out? I declare, this weather of late is conspiring to put me out of business. You gals like sarsaparilla?
Jenny's mouth began to water. It had been ages.
We don't have any money, Miss Abigail, but thank you anyway.
Megan looked at her as if she'd like to toss her over the stockade, and Jenny stared down at her hands.
Not everything in here is for sale, you sillies. I just thought we'd have a nice friendly soda pop. Been forever since I got to sit and socialize.
And she was off behind the bar. Megan and Jenny exchanged glances, but Abigail was back by then, with three bottles of sarsaparilla, three glasses, a bottle opener, and a small bowl of real ice. Jenny was transfixed, but Megan was halfway through her first glass. If you put enough ice in the glass, your bottle was enough to pour out twice. Jenny looked away from Abigail long enough to ice her glass, then fill it with sarsaparilla. It bubbled up into fizz when it hit the ice. Abigail lifted her glass.
To old friends.
To old friends.
Until her dying day, Jenny would swear that was the best sarsaparilla she ever drank.
What the hell's going on out here? A hen party?
Both Jenny and Megan twisted in their chairs to see the speaker. He was coming out of the mouth of the hall behind him, all spurs and hip pistols and worn blue jeans, and nothing up top except his long johns. And his hat, of course. Jenny didn't understand why, in the West, nobody took off his hat, not even to greet a lady. Not even in church. Her brother aside, just a touch of the brim was the most she'd seen since they left Kansas. But this man, whom Jenny liked already, just on general principle, not only took his hat clear off, but bowed to the table. Then he swept his hat wide.
Good morning, ladies. I trust everyone came through the night in one piece.
He looked at Abigail and raised his brows, indicating the empty chair at the table.
May I?
Certainly.
The man sat down, right next to Jenny, who nearly fainted. He was tall, as tall as Jason, over 6 feet, had wavy, sandy hair, and it was cut fairly short. His eyes were a deep, deep blue as she imagined the ocean would be if you swam down so far that your lungs were ready to burst. And he was, well, gorgeous, if you could call a man that.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Lynch, Rafe Lynch. I'd appreciate it if you'd call me Rafe.
Hello, Rafe. I'm Jenny Fury.
Like the town. Coincidence?
Her father was the wagon master who started us west, and her brother is our marshal. And I'm Megan McDonald, and my brother owns the bank.
Yes. What Megan said, I mean.
Jenny felt herself flush hotly and took a quick sip of her soda pop. It was Abigail who saved her. She reached over and put a hand on Rafe's arm.
Can I get you something, honey?
Rafe picked a little chunk of ice out of the bowl and ran it over his forehead.
A beer, if you wouldn't mind, Abby.
No problem at all. Rafe, honey, why don't you tell the girls just how you beat that dust storm to town? I swan, I would have been scared to death.
Don't take much to scare you, does it, Abby? How old are you two? Unless it's uncalled for to ask, I mean.
I'm 21. Jenny here is only 19.
But I'll be 20 come June.
And your brother's the famous Jason Fury I've been hearing so much about.
Yes, I guess so. But he's just my brother.
Rafe Lynch ran the last of his ice over his forehead again, then popped it into his mouth. He pointed an index finger at Jenny.
You're funny. Well, I heard about him back in California. Something about a couple of Indian attacks. And yeah, something else. That's gone right out of my head for the time being.
Abigail was back and slid his beer across the table before she sat down again.
You tell him yet how you beat that dust storm?
Jenny wanted to know what the other thing was that he'd heard about Jason, but held her tongue. Rafe shook his head and took a big swallow of his beer, while Jenny tried not to stare. He was so handsome and charming, and had little lines that fanned out from the corners of his deep blue eyes when he smiled. Even his name was wonderful. She'd never known anyone called Rafe before. She was smitten. Over in California, near the Pacific coast and the upstart town of Los Angeles, Ezra Welk sat at the back of his room at Maria's place, listening to the morning birds singing over the desert while he smoked a cigar. He was a tall man, although he preferred to think of himself as compact, and he studied the ash on the end of his cigar before he rolled it off on the edge of the sole of his boot. He was alone in the room, and had been ever since 7, when the little Spitfire he'd spent the night with had left.
Merlina. Quite the little bucking bronca, that gal.
He hoped her next rider was as satisfied as he was. He rolled the ash off the end of his cigar in the ashtray this time.
Cut glass pretending to be crystal.
He wasn't that tired. Well, maybe a bit tuckered out from Senorita Merlina, but that'd pass. No, if he was tired of anything, he supposed it was just life itself.
That's a funny thing, ain't it?
He couldn't think of another way to put it, though. When a feller was sick and tired of, well, everything. He took another drag on his cigar, then put it out before he stood up and gave his collar a tug. He supposed he'd best see about finding himself some breakfast, and then think about what to do.
This is all Benny Atkinson's fault. Why in hell did Benny have to show up in the first place?
West of Fury, the wagon train sat forlornly, broken and wind-whipped. Two of the wagons had blown clean over during the night, killing the occupants of one of them. The Banyans had managed to fall asleep somehow, and when their wagon went over, they were crushed by Martha's shiffer robe. It had taken 2 men with shovels to scrape up Darren's skull. 3 of the other men had set off to dig a couple of holes, and it wouldn't be very long before he was asked to come out and say some words over the dearly departed.
What do I say? That Darren Banyan was the second of the cheapest cheapskate I ever met? But that he was a good man with his horses, and Martha, that she could be sharp-tongued, and had already caused more than one blow-up in the troop, but that she could sing so sweet and pretty that it could make a grown man go all gooey.
He'd leave the Bible thumping to a couple of the travelers. They sure enough had a crop of them on this journey, including a real Catholic priest. But he supposed that Samson Davis, wherever he was, leveled the field, good and evil wise. There was something just plain nasty about the man. Riley seldom wished any man ill, but may the good Lord forgive him, he hoped that Samson Davis had died in the dust storm. Young Bill Cratchit, a 16-year-old on his own and with his own wagon, stepped around to the tailgate where Riley was sitting.
Mr. Havens, I guess we're ready for you, sir.
Riley hopped down, then ground out his smoke under his boot. The two of them started toward the burial site.
Thanks, Bill. Samson Davis show up yet?
Oh, yeah. Rode in half an hour ago. Why?
No reason. Just keeping tabs on the train members, that's all.
They came to the site of the graves. Somebody had found the wood and twine to tie together some rude crosses, and the bodies had already been lowered. When the gathered crowd saw Riley and Bill coming, they stopped their low hum of conversation and looked toward Riley. He took off his hat.
Yeah, I'm not one for Bible verses. I'll let you, Fletch, or you, Father, take care of that part. But I can tell you about the Banyans. I didn't know them long, but long enough to know that Darren was the best I've seen for soothing a colicky mare or knowing how to hitch his team just right, so they didn't ever soar or come up lame. Martha was a beauty. When it came to singing a tune, I doubt anyone would say she wasn't the best they'd ever heard, especially in a wagon camp when people need some of the civilized things around them. Fine things like music and manners. Well, maybe I made a bad choice of words right there, but I think all of you know what I meant. And now, if one of you more religious gents will take over.
He stepped aside, and Fletcher Bean took his place between the head markers. Solemnly, he bowed his head and opened his Bible.
Let us pray.
Jason got up the nerve to go talk to Rafe Lynch around 2 p.m, long after the girls had gone home. He found himself walking slower and slower as he neared Abigail's place, though, and had to mentally kick himself in the rump for being so scared.
Lynch isn't gonna do anything. Not ruin his harbor and a whole fresh territory.
That helped a little, so he was walking faster when he came up to Solomon's store. He knew full well that it was Sunday, but that had never before stopped Solomon from being open. Curious, he stopped and peeked in the front window, cupping a hand over his eyes to cut the glare. What he saw surprised him. He saw the back room door open and Dr. Morelli step out and shake hands with Solomon, who'd been kneeling against a counter. The look on Solomon's face was ecstatic, and he pushed Morelli aside to go into the room. But Morelli blocked his passage, speaking to him very seriously. Solomon nodded just as solemnly, and then burst out in a fresh grin. He leapt up in the air.
A girl! It's a girl!
Solomon then gave Morelli one of those big bear hugs of his. Morelli freed himself after a moment, and when he walked outside again, Jason was standing there on the boardwalk, smiling at him.
Lived, didn't it?
Yes, she did. I'm very happy for them, but...
But what?
The baby isn't quite right, Jason. I think there's something wrong with her heart. But it was a tad early. Sometimes these things fix themselves with time, if there is any. This may have been what killed the boys, too, but since their religion prohibits any sort of post-mortem...
He stared at the ground for a moment.
Well, I must go. My wife's waiting dinner for me.
He tipped his hat and cut across the street, making a beeline for his house. Jason leaned back against the storefront.
Well, I'll be dogged. I hope Morelli's right about time fixing things. Last thing I need is Solomon shooting up the place again.
He walked toward Abigail's place.
Ouch!
Jason whipped around and saw that it was Solomon Cohen himself, gun in hand.
It's a girl! It's a girl!
He took off at a dead run right down the center of town. Jason took off right after him. He caught up with Solomon and wrested the gun away from him.
Yes, we know it's a girl. I reckon even the Apache practically down on the Mexican border know it too.
But it's a girl, Jason, and she's alive!
Jason blinked and had to quickly shift his position when Solomon tried to take his gun back.
There'll be none of that now. Why don't you come on over to the office and we'll toast her with a cup of coffee. I made it. Ward didn't.
Ward made terrible coffee.
What? Jason, you're not going to arrest me, are you?
Just until you settle yourself down. I can't have you running all over town shooting and maiming folks.
I'm not going to...
Jason began to get them aimed toward the jail.
I know, Solomon. I know you're not trying to harm a soul. But you got to admit that you're not the best shot. What if you was to shoot somebody by accident and they died? Think about how bad you'd feel then. Now think about how bad I'd feel having to hang you after all we've been through together.
By this time, Jason had Solomon nearly to the office, and Saul wasn't fighting him. But in the half-second it took to let go his arm and open the office door, Solomon snatched back the pistol and jumped away.
Yahoo!
Jason grabbed him from behind, shaking his wrist until the gun fell into the dirt.
Jesus Christ, Solomon, give me a break, all right?
You shouldn't be taking the name of a prophet in vain.
And you shouldn't be allowed anywhere near firearms when your wife's having a baby.
Jason shoved him back toward the jailhouse. This time, he got him clear through the front door and locked in a cell, then had to run outside again to pick up his gun. When he got back inside, Solomon was looking at him expectantly.
So, I was promised coffee already.
By the time that Ward showed up to relieve Jason, Solomon had calmed down enough that Jason figured to let him go. Not his gun, though, just him. He could pick up the pistol tomorrow. Jason walked with him as far as the mercantile.
I got some business to take care of next door. See you tomorrow, Solomon.
Giving a last slap on the back to Solomon, he turned and walked over to Abigail's.
You're brave enough to do this before, you lughead. It's only talk, right?
There was no Rafe Lynch present. Just a few fellas from town and three girls, Abigail among them. He made no move to sit, but raised his hand to Abigail in a subtle wave. She came right over.
What can I do you for, Jason? A drink? A girl? Your sister and Megan were in this morning, coming to get out of the rain. Oh, we had us a grand old time. Had sarsaparilla and the last of the ice to boot.
Jason was shocked that the girls had set foot over Abigail's threshold.
Rafe Lynch here?
No, he moved camp down the street to the saloon. I don't know what they got that I don't.
Likely bigger card games, Abigail.
Jason thumbed back his hat, relieved. If Lynch had changed his base of operation for the time being, there was less chance that Megan or Jenny would run into him. He didn't want his little sister or his gal, Megan, having anything to do with a murderer. Abigail wasn't paying any attention. Her eyes were on the three-man poker game a few tables away. Jason glanced that way, too.
Thanks, Abigail. I'll be going on home then.
All right. Is Ward on duty?
Yeah. Why?
I might need him later on, that's all.
Why?
I think I got a card cheat down there. Not sure yet, though.
Then suddenly she threw her arm around Jason's waist and turned him around toward the door.
Well, you go on home and have some of that good old supper I know Jenny's cooking up for you, okay?
Sure you don't want me to stick around for a while?
But she practically shoved him back outside.
You take care now, you hear?
Then she was gone, and Jason had nothing to look at but her outside wall. Well, whatever it was, if it was anything at all, Ward could take care of it. Jason shrugged and headed back up the street toward home. At home, the kitchen was buzzing when Jason walked in. In fact, they didn't seem to notice his passage into the house and back to his room. He was glad that Meg was staying for dinner, and he was even gladder to find that the filthy pile of clothes he'd left on the floor had been picked up and laundered, and presently lay neatly folded in his bureau. But he hadn't escaped unseen. Jenny appeared in his doorway, arms folded.
Well, did you drag half the territory home in your clothes again?
Jason doffed his hat solemnly.
No, ma'am. I decided to let Ward take a turn tonight.
Good. It's only fair. Supper in 10 minutes.
She turned on her heel and disappeared down the hall. Jason hung his hat on the bedpost and then sat on the bed. He pinched the brim of his nose to help keep himself awake. The kitten. He had to remember to tell Jenny. He'd forgotten all about it until just now. Well, pinching his nose a few times didn't seem to do the trick, because the next thing he knew, he was stretched out on the bed and Jenny was back in the doorway, her toe tapping.
Are you coming or not?
Oh, yeah, it'd be right there.
I swan, Jason Fury. I don't know what you'd do if left to your own devices. Sleep straight through until you were 60, probably.
He raised his arm to make a point, but she had already gone. He sniffed the air.
Oh, chicken and gravy.
His mouth began to water, and suddenly he was standing up and on his way down the hall. Jenny's gravy pulled at him like a magnet. He smiled as he sat down at the table. He snapped open his napkin and tucked it into his collar.
Jenny, you've done it again. Smells great.
She carried a platter over to the table and slid it down beside him.
I can remember a time when you were afraid I was going to blow up the kitchen every time I cooked.
Megan looked up from her plate at that, and Jason gave her a wink.
Well, Jenny, all I had to go on was past experience.
One time that happened, and that was clear back in Kansas City, Jason!
Now, sister, I admit it. You've improved tremendously. I actually look forward to coming home to your cooking, and that's the truth of it.
Don't go throwing those college words around, you'll show off. Tremendously. Honest to gosh.
Jason tried to look innocent, but failed miserably. Jenny sat down and shook out her napkin.
We almost had a guest for dinner, besides Meg, I mean.
How so? And Meg isn't a guest. She knows she's welcome here any old time, right, Megan?
It was the nicest man, Jason. We met him this morning, and he was just so nice.
But we left before Jenny thought to ask him.
And when we went back, he was gone.
The girls were doing it again. They had him holding one conversation with two girls who seemed to be reading each other's minds. He didn't believe they even realized they were doing it.
Who was he?
Oh, he had the most beautiful name, too. It was Rafe.
Rafe Lynch. The first name's prettier than the last.
You were at Abigail's when you met him.
Now, Jason, don't be cross. We just ducked in to get out of the rain, and when we went inside, Abigail was the only one there.
Still, you know you're not supposed to be in there. Especially hanging around with the likes of Rafe Lynch. He's a dangerous man, Jenny. And you pay attention too, Meg. He's wanted for 8 murders in California. 8. He's a cold-blooded killer. And you're not to go anywhere near him again.
But Jason...
No! Damn that Lynch. Why'd he have to stop over in fury?
He remembered the gravy then. When he looked up again, Jenny was close to tears. He reached to put a hand on her arm, but she snatched it away.
Don't!
He switched his attention to Megan, who was shoving away from the table.
What?
You're terrible, Jason. He was just lovely, really nice. There must be 2 Rafe Lynches, that's what it is, and Jenny and I met the good one. He couldn't possibly be a killer. He's well-spoken, and he told us about beating the storm into town, and...
And he has little crinkles at the corners of his eyes!
Jason knew full well that if there was more than one Rafe Lynch, this wasn't him. They had the real honest-to-God Rafe Lynch setting up shop, and he was a very bad man. And Jason knew from previous experience that Jenny seemed to have a fatal attraction to bad men. She had made the same deluded observations about Matt McDonald before her ill-fated marriage to him. But in order to calm the girls, and also to avoid ruining a perfectly good meal, he decided to take the middle road.
All right, maybe there is more than one Rafe Lynch. Well, I'll check it out first thing tomorrow morning. Everybody happy again?
Megan scraped her chair back toward the table, and Jenny took the gravy boat from Jason's hand. The situation was calmed, at least for the present. However, it seemed that Jason was doomed to have a troubled supper time.
That apple pie looks tasty. Who in the hell?
He rose and walked to the front door after motioning the girls to stay put. Jason opened the door to find Deputy Ward Wanamaker, fist cocked back and aimed directly at Matt McDonald, whom he held by the collar, and who was also the last person Jason expected to find in Fury that day. Ward was a tall string bean of a man and had about 4 inches on Matt, and Matt looked, well, afraid.
I already told him about 20 times that we ain't got no jurisdiction out at his place, but he kept shouting as how he wanted to talk to somebody in authority, not no stupid deputy. So I brung him here. This here's the highest authority in Fury, Matthew.
Once again, Jason pulled on the cloak of Peacemaker.
Let go of him, Ward.
Ward gradually loosened his grip and lowered his punching arm, and for just a second, Jason thought that Matt was going to run. He had a habit of running away from bad situations, but he didn't.
I imagine you're gonna be as useless as usual.
If you got problems out at your place, you're right. What is it this time?
My cattle, goddammit. Somebody stole two of my cattle.
Sorry to hear that, Matt.
You're not sorry at all. You got it in for anything or anybody attached to me. And I swear I...
You swear what, Matthew?
Megan had just appeared at Jason's side, her napkin in her hand. Jenny had disappeared into the kitchen. She generally avoided having contact with Matt unless it was absolutely necessary. Matt simply stood there, boiling for a moment.
You get yourself home, young lady, or there'll be hell to pay, you understand?
Don't move, Megan.
Wouldn't think of it.
Matt glared daggers at her before he turned on his heel and marched, glowering, down the steps and across the yard to the street, where he turned and shook his fist.
I won't forget this, Fury!
I suppose he wants to rename the town McDonald, too.
Matt disappeared around the corner.
You can be my guest. What about his cattle, anyway?
Says somebody swiped two of them. You ask me, it's a puma, or maybe a Mexican grizzly.
Ward was probably right. They both stood there, heads shaking for a moment.
You want something to eat? Jenny did it again. Fried chicken and mashed with gravy, green beans, and pie. Whew!
Well, don't keep yammering at me. Just get out of the way.
Grinning, Jason stepped aside as Ward walked past him.
Hey, Jenny, set another plate, because a man with a powerful appetite's coming to supper.
As Ward disappeared into the kitchen, Jason turned back to Megan, who was vacantly watching the empty road.
Megan, I'm sorry.
It's all right. I know he's a jackass, but he's my brother and I have to accept it. You don't, thank God. Now let's go have some of that apple pie.
She linked her arm through his and led him back to the kitchen, where Ward was already gobbling down fried chicken like somebody was going to toss it to the hogs if he didn't rush. Before the sun went down, Ezra Welk made camp. He'd been riding easy most all of the day, which had been largely uneventful, save for the unusually large herd of pronghorn which had crossed his path in the morning. And all day long, even while he sat there, wrists crossed over his saddle horn while he watched those pronghorns, he'd been thinking about that lame brain, Benny Atkinson.
Whatever possessed Benny to track me to Los Angeles? And why was he dumb enough to call me out right in front of God and everybody?
It boggled Ezra that anyone, even a so-called bounty hunter like Atkinson, would be dumb enough to try that. Especially when he had to know damn well that he was an inferior gunman to Ezra. Well, apparently he hadn't, because he'd called out Ezra loud enough that they could have heard him down by the docks and sealed his own fate just like that. Ezra had left him lying in the street, his pooling blood catching the dust sent up by Ezra's pony's heels as he beat it out of town. What law there was in Los Angeles didn't like him much to begin with, and he didn't figure to stick around and wait to see how they liked him now. Now, Ezra had been riding out of Arizona, and it was a pretty dumb thing for Ezra to be headed back toward its border, but he was. At least Arizona was pretty much wide open. If you could steer clear of Indians and skirt the towns, of which there weren't many, you were in the clear. Same thing went for New Mexico and most of Texas, but then he wasn't wanted in Texas.
Yet? Well, there's still time, and I'm still youngish.
Matt McDonald made it home before nightfall and had one of the hands walk his horse, for it was sweating like it would never stop and lathered like a visit to a $2 barber.
That's all I need right now. A messed up horse. And all on account of that damn Jason Fury.
He slammed into the ranch house, then changed his mind. He walked outside again.
Send Curly up here!
The knock came less than 5 minutes later.
Get your lazy butt in here, Curly!
Curly stepped in, grabbing the door by its latch and forcing it back up into position.
What the hell happened, boss?
Never mind the damn door.
Sure, boss. What do you want?
Tomorrow, I want everybody to stop what they were working on and start building a new corral next to the barn. A big one. I'm not going to lose any more cattle, you hear me? I want it big enough to hold every single cow, steer, and bull we've got on the place, with plenty of room for them to move around.
What are we going to feed them, boss? I mean, out on the range, they got forage, sorta.
We're going to feed them hay and corn, you dolt.
Yeah, boss. First thing.
All right, then. You can go now.
Curly tipped his hat and turned to struggle once again with the door.
You want I should send somebody to fix this?
Of course.
Yes, sir. Right away, sir.
Matt sat down at the table, clenching his bourbon so tightly that the glass broke.
God!
He found a cloth and wrapped it around his bleeding hand, then found another to pick up the broken glass and soak up the whiskey.
It's all Fury's fault. Everything's Fury's fault.
The glass picked up and the whiskey sopped. He threw the whole mess in the trash basket beside the sink.
And Megan, that ungrateful little wench.
She was too old and too big to spank, but he'd think of something. Something that would put her in her place once and for all. He'd had enough of her habit of hanging around with Jenny Fury. Especially after Jenny and her cursed brother had gotten the town council to grant Jenny a divorce on the grounds that Matt had abandoned her. Well, he had come back, dammit. But the deed was done, and Jenny had refused to have anything to do with him ever since. Megan was his sister. Whatever happened to family loyalty? He'd also had enough of her running his bank. He gave her the job. He could damn well take it away. On second thought, he'd best leave that one alone. Megan had a keen head for figures, better than his, and there'd been no complaints about her work. But he'd fix her wagon all right. Fix it so that there'd be no more backtalk and no more crossing him. But first, he had to gather in his cattle. The door caved halfway in, exposing a wide-eyed and blinking ranch hand. Matt noted the sky was dark behind him.
Curly told you what to do?
Yes, sir.
Well, get to it, then.
And then, his hand still bleeding into the wrapping towel, Matt stalked off to find himself some dinner. He thought Megan had made cookies or a cake or something the last time she was here. He thought there was a chance it was still edible. The next morning found Matt up bright and early, overseeing the work on the corral. There was still plenty of wood left over from the barn, and he had two men splitting it into usable sizes for posts and rough boards. Right at the moment, he was more concerned with getting the thing built than what it would look like. His men didn't much agree with him, but they were smart enough to keep their opinions to themselves. They just went about their work with a distinct lack of enthusiasm. Matt was still too head up to notice, though. He just kept pacing from man to man to man, hardly speaking, just staring at the ground, and every once in a while glancing up at the work.
Blast that Jason Fury, anyway.
He'd thought he could rustle up some men in town, at least. Some volunteers to help him find who was thieving him blind. Those cows weren't just cows. They were purebreds. Well, mostly pure half-bloods that his father had brought all the way out here. Well, until he fell down the side of a mountain in the middle of nowhere while they were on their way out. His stomach rumbled. He hadn't eaten any breakfast, and it was almost lunchtime. He hadn't had much luck nosing around the kitchen last night, either. Meg had made a batch of ginger cookies, but they were so dried out that they were nearly impossible to eat. And the thing was, he knew that when she'd made them fresh, they'd been puffy and chewy and altogether wonderful. But he'd forgotten about them. Just like he'd forgotten to pick up any groceries while he was in town.
Curly!
Curly trotted up to him, hammer in hand.
Yeah, boss?
Tell the bunkhouse cook to fix an extra lunch plate and have somebody bring it up to the house to me.
Yes, sir.
And have the boys light a fire under it. I want this thing finished and the cattle all brought in before I lose any more of them.
Yes, sir.
Matt turned his back and marched up toward the house, his stomach gurgling and thirst parching his throat. He hoped Cookie would get the lead out and slap him together some lunch pronto. But first, he needed some whiskey. A lot of whiskey.
Damn that Jason Fury anyway.
Riley had started the train out early. At least, what was left of it. He just hoped that Fury had a couple of usable canvas covers that his two topless families could buy cheap, which wasn't always the case with these little upstart towns. He had one of his Shank's Mare members driving the late Darren and Martha Banyan's rig, battered and tattered though it was. The other wagon, tipped by the wind, hadn't been mangled as badly, thank God, but the Banyan's looked like it had been to hell and back, then run through a ringer. Several of the fellas had shored up the rear axle and done their best to patch up the broken wheel, but they were just temporary fixes. As it was, the wagon just lurched along. He hoped that Fury had somebody who knew his way around to Conestoga, too. He may have lost the Banyans, but he'd, by God, get their belongings back to their folks. He was staking a lot on Fury, he realized. He prayed that the fellow he'd run across in that bar back on the coast had been right, and that Fury was a nice, friendly little town. He turned to see who was riding up on him. It was Samson Davis, so he'd survived the storm after all. Try as he might, Riley couldn't help feeling disappointed, but he fought to cover it up. Samson reined in his bay next to Riley and began to pace him.
How long till we hit Fury?
Before nightfall, I reckon.
What's your hurry? More to the point, where were you last night?
Davis had reined his horse around and was galloping back to the train before Riley had a chance to open his mouth again.
Rick.
He turned his attention back to the rugged landscape that lay ahead of him.